All right, here we go. Man, got a great show this evening. Man, settle down, people. Settle down. We haven't even brought our guest in yet. They're already, I mean, they're on their feet, clapping.
Hey.
Jackal Monkey, how are you, sir? I'm Otis B. Dreads, as you all know. This is Jackal Monkey here, and this is Night 11 Dreads. This is one of those shows that we're not only broadcasting over to the Night of the Living Dreads Facebook group, but also over there to Scurry Face as well. So a lot of people waiting for our guest. Before we get, you know, and bring our guest, Mr. Robert, a.k.a. Bobby Ray Schaefer, or Bob Vance from Vance Refrigeration, as most people may know him. Before we get into all of that good discussion, Nightmare Ninja Studios, my friend, tell people where they can get a mask.
Yeah, hit me up on Facebook, Nightmare Ninja Studios. Do all kinds of custom latex pieces. Do some hockey masks, Hannibal Lecter masks. So, I mean, if you need a custom mask made, hit me up and we'll make your nightmares become a reality. Jeez. If you have a film that you're working on and you need a mask or a prop, hit me up and we'll make your nightmares become a reality.
He's got all kinds of nightmares for your reality. And of course... And of course, Night of the Living Dreads, the audio podcast. All of these interviews will be on our YouTube channel. And man, we've had some really good guests, some awesome guests here lately. And tonight is not going to be any different. Definitely. No different. Again, you probably know our guest from The Office. That's right. Bob Vance, Vance's Refrigeration. You may also know him as the deranged, satanic, you know, devil-worshipping psycho cop in Psycho Cop 1 and 2. And you also may know him as Dickster. What a great name, by the way.
Love it. Love it.
What an awesome name. What an awesome name. So without further ado, let's bring in Mr. Robert Ray Shaw. Robert, how are you, sir?
I'm fine. Thank you, Otis. Jacko, good evening.
Thank you,
everybody listening.
This is going to be a fun, funny show, I believe. I've watched some of your interviews. I've got some little points that I want to bring up. Let's just start from the beginning. You were born, you said, in West Virginia, but you grew up as a child in Bowie, Maryland.
I did live there a few years. Bowie and Wheaton, Silver Spring, you know, that whole area.
I actually, my grandmother's house is about 20, 25 minutes from Bowie in Glen Burnie. Have you heard of that?
Sure.
Yes. So I thought that was kind of cool. Are you an Orioles fan?
I was a Senators fan.
Okay.
That was when they still had the original Senators. Frank Hondo Howard played first base, the Washington Monument, 6'8". Hit 40 home runs a year. I love that team. I remember they sent me a bunch of autographed pictures. You know, I wrote them a letter, please send me pictures, and about 10 guys on the team did. So that was my first experience with fame, was pictures from the Senators.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So growing up, I heard you were a big Happy Days fan growing up. I love me some Happy Days when I was growing up. Along with Happy Days, were you a Carol Burnett fan? Because I think I heard something about Carol Burnett was maybe supposed to be in a movie, or you were going to possibly, maybe she was thought about playing a role.
She wanted to be on The Office. I mean, at the first Emmy in 2006, when we won the Emmy Award, she got a Lifetime Achievement Award there. And when she was giving her speech, she told the executive producer, Greg Daniels, I'd like to be on the show. Well, at the time, he said, we can't have Carol Burnett on the show. She's too famous. It would ruin the authenticity of the show. And of course, later on, everybody in Hollywood did a cameo. So that went out the window. You know, we can't have famous people on the show. That sailed away. But, you know, I mean, I was like, get Carol Burnett. Yeah, let's get Carol Burnett. Let's make her Bob Vance's mother.
Right. That would have been awesome.
Working with a legend like Carol Burnett. I mean, such a gifted farceur. I mean, really, there's very few women in that category. And she was one of them.
That is awesome. So I guess you were a big fan of the Carol Burnett show back in the late 60s, early 70s.
What else was on TV that night? It was Saturday night, right? There was three channels. There wasn't much on. And, you know, Harvey,
yeah.
And Tim Conway. I mean, they were very funny, very gifted. That stuff still holds up, some of those bits.
Oh, yeah. You know,
that comedy will live on. I mean, it still works.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to take a quick second. Thank everybody for joining us in the chat. Again, we're over there. Scurry Face over there at NLD. Thank you all for joining in with our discussion with Sir Bobby Ray Shaver. Bob Vance, come on. Tell us who you are. I know people are waiting to hear this.
You know, I've only been saying this line for 16 years now, so I've you know, I say it the same way I said it on the first time I walked on the show in 2005. Bob Vance, Vance Refrigeration. That's who knew? I mean, that's 17 seconds of comedy gold. It actually was number 5 on a top 10 list of best office moments. I never would have thought that. I mean, so that was a sweet. I mean, everybody's got a list, right? But still, it's kind of a surprise. And, you know, the merchandising of the character, who knew? I mean, there's no way to know that sort of thing. And I always say, you know, really, I did the most with the least. So it's a thrill and it's an honor. I mean, we're doing things with that show now, I mean, that no one in TV history has ever done. I mean, it's bigger now than when we were making it, way bigger. And so who knew that? I mean, that's a big surprise. So it's been a wonderful ride, I'll say that. You know, every bit of it's been a blessing. It's tough when you're doing it because, you know, as a recurring character, you want to be a regular. You want more. You want more scenes, more lines. Right. I mean, so it's a double-edged sword, you know. I mean, you're thrilled with the piece, but you're also, you know, you like when I play basketball, I like to take the shot. You know, right. I wanted to jack it up. I like to pass the ball too, but you know, I wanted to be the guy shooting it. So you want to take the shot, you know. So it's kind of tough to sit the bench, you know. That's the one aspect of it that people don't understand. But for an actor, when you're out about, you know, out in the world, and people go, wait, I know you, and now you can just go. The Office. You know, you don't have to explain yourself. Well, I did a commercial with Kenny Rogers. I did Psycho Cop. I was on Criminal Minds. I did, you know, Adam Ruins Everything.
You don't have to go through your resume.
You can just go to The Office, and then you're done with it.
You did a commercial with Kenny Rogers?
Yeah, I did The Gambler for Geico.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a great spot. I mean, it was a great day. How could you ever have a better day? You're working with Kenny Rogers. I'm sitting there. I'm in awe of Kenny Rogers. I mean, this guy has done it all. He's a huge talent. I used to bartend on Sunset Boulevard in a building owned by Kenny Rogers. I mean, when I brought that up in our conversation, he was very pleased. Oh, yes. That's he was happy you owned that building. But, you know, I mean, I learned stuff. I mean, he told me that, for instance, Islands in the Stream, the number one smash hit single with Dolly Parton, that was an accident. He just happened to be in the recording studio that day. Dolly walked in. He said, hey, will you sing on this record with me? And she said, yes. And then voila. Magic.
That's awesome.
I mean, that's one of the, you know, that's that song. I mean, it's brilliant. It still works. I mean, and it sold millions and millions of copies.
Yes, it did.
You know, Kenny Rogers discovered the Eagles. You know, I mean, Kenny Rogers, you know, was not only a great singer, writer, but he was also a great actor. I mean, he did it all. I mean, what didn't he do? I mean, he had 40 years at the top of the game, at all the different games. So, you know, I have nothing but mad respect, and it was an awesome experience to not only meet him, but, you know, hang out.
That's great. Speaking of The Office, and then I want to hand it over to Jacko Monkey, because apparently it is a thing in their household that they watch The Office on a religious level.
Sure.
But my son CJ, he's a junior. My son, he texts me a question because he's also a huge fan of The Office. He's also a huge horror fan. Now, Rainn Wilson, as you know, had that part in The House of 1,000 Corpses, the Rob Zombie horror film. What was it like working with him? What kind of a character is Rainn, he?
Rainn is an eccentric guy, you know, but he's a very smart man. I have much respect for him and his choices as well. He proves himself in lots of different ways all the time. I'm impressed by Rainn Wilson.
Awesome. So, I mean, what kind of cut-ups? Because I know there was all kinds of bloopers and outtakes. I think Jackal Monkey, you wanted to know a little bit about that. So I'll ask that, and then Jackal Monkey, the floor is yours when it comes to The Office, because we're getting ready to get into some Psycho Cop and Dickster.
Well, the thing,
awesome.
Is that people didn't really blow takes, right? I mean, you're on such a tight schedule that you don't take the liberty of blowing a take. You want to do it, you know, as best you can. Now, John and Rainn and Steve would occasionally switch something around to try to make each other laugh, and that would make the outtakes. And of course, everyone always had outtakes on their every single "That's What She Said." I mean, the fact that we were even able to do "That's What She Said." I mean, they put them all together one night at one of our rap parties, and there was probably 100 of them in a row, and no one has ever laughed harder than we did that night. We cracked ourselves up.
Oh, I bet.
More than the audience ever laughed at the show. We thought we were funny. And, you know, a lot of the time we were.
Yeah, and that was one thing I was wanting to ask, too. Your mom and dad are actually named Bob and Phyllis, right?
That is correct, and that is well-done research. I mean, what are the odds of that? In fact, Phyllis's name is Phyllis Smith. My mother's maiden name was Phyllis Smith. So it was really weird. It, you know, the first time I learned that, I said, "Is your middle name Kay?" Because that was my mother's middle name. I was like, "If your middle name is Kay, I'm really going to have a I'm going to have a little mental breakdown here." And the odd thing is that I had read for Phyllis maybe 5 years before that. You know, she was a casting director. And a really good one. I mean, she worked for Allison Jones. Allison Jones is the top comedy casting director in Los Angeles. She does all the Will Ferrell movies. She does all the A-list movies. Allison Jones. So that's how Phyllis got the job. And the funny thing was is that for years, while the show was on and then afterwards, every casting director's office that I would go into would say, "Did you know Phyllis was the casting director?" And I always had to go, "Yes, yes, I knew. I know that Phyllis was making $30,000 a year and suddenly wasn't." Right. Suddenly she was buying Mary Tyler Moore's old house in the hills in Hollywood.
Wow. That's awesome, though.
Yeah, I mean, no, the first director loved her readings so much that he said, "You need to be in the show." You know, Creed was a background guy the first time, and he cut a tape that he convinced Greg Daniels to watch, and he got on the show full time. And of course, you know, you can't think of The Office without Creed.
Oh, right.
Think about that.
Absolutely.
I mean, Creed had an incredible impact on the show.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Creed's one of my favorite people. He was a huge rock and roll star when he was a young man.
Right, in the Grassroots.
The Grassroots, they had a bunch of hits. I mean, that Sooner or Later.
Wow.
I mean, Midnight Temptation. I mean, tons of number ones. I mean, I used to listen to them when I was a little kid on Casey Kasem's Top 40 radio show every week, you know, and he and Ed Helms would always sit around on the set and play their guitars. I mean, they were very entertaining.
Oh, I bet. Oh, I imagine. They're
and I would always want to talk to him about the old days. I want to talk to him about it when he was a rock and roll star. You know?
Yeah, right. I'll hear this, you know, story.
18
you know?
Build on The Office.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, geez, you imagine the stories he's got. You know what I mean?
Well, like, he was in rock and roll when rock and roll was real.
Right.
When exactly. Rock and roll wasn't corporate rock and roll. When rock and roll wasn't pre-manufactured and auto-tuned and, you know, guys really got out and played. You know, I mean, it was a different era in music for sure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And those are the stories that, you know, you kind of want to hear. Let me ask you about this. We're gonna step away from The Office.
Sure.
Just for a moment, because I heard you mention in another interview that you actually pitched a bowling comedy movie that turned into Kingpin.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, I just loved bowling. I was in a bowling league at the time, and I was writing a lot of comedies at the time, and I hadn't learned to keep my mouth shut. You know, I was still
join the crowd.
Those days.
Right.
So you go out to Hollywood parties, and you run into producers, and you pitch them. You know, here's what I did. You know, I wrote a script in every single genre. You know, I had a horror film. I had a romantic comedy. I had an action picture. I had a futuristic space picture. I mean, I wrote something in every genre. So then whenever I would pitch, I would say, listen, what are you looking for? You're looking for an action film. And they would go, no, I'm really looking for a romantic comedy. That way, then I would go, I happen to have one.
Right. That's
so
awesome.
It's just a writer's exercise more than anything, you know, but pitching, you know, that happens every single day. And, you know, my idea was pretty much the same as the movie. The movie's genius. Kingpin is one of my favorite movies. I love it. I mean, it's so good. So funny. And it holds up. I mean, I met Peter Farrelly when my buddy Nick Vallelonga was doing Green Book. So, you know, very good director. Obviously, those guys, they're comic geniuses, really. I mean, that's right. Why it was such a great departure to see him do Green Book. And every now and then, his comic stuff would just start to creep in. You know, he couldn't help it. And you got Viggo Mortensen. You know, I don't know if you've seen Green Book, but it's a wonderful little picture. And well, it's an Academy Award winner.
Right.
So apparently it's a good picture. Now, Jacko Monkey, I have to throw this in before I forget it. I saw you, Bobby, rap on another interview that you did. Can you do that for us right now?
Because wow, that is pressure, you know, just to say
it is. Okay, rap. It is.
Let me set it up first and see if I can recall the words. It's been a while since I've done it. It the rap has to do with Psycho Cop 3. We, you know, I wrote the script for Psycho Cop 3. For years, people have been saying to me, please make another one. Please make another one.
I agree.
And I didn't really want to. I was like, I've already done it. What else can I do with it? And so finally, what motivated me was I heard somebody wanted to remake it. I was like, hell no, that's mine. Don't touch that. You know, I got really possessive all of a sudden. I was like, what do you mean remake it?
Right?
I'm still alive.
Like
and, you know, I'm still
spirit,
man.
You know.
And so I wrote it. It's hip hop psycho cop. That crazy ass cracker going to shoot you if you smoke that rock. Bang, boom, he in the room. He got his nine out laughing and he got his nine out blazing and he laughing too. Fuck you, boy in blue.
Love it. Love it.
Well, Psycho Cop 3, I wanted to make a really dark, scary horror film. I mean, not at a very old school horror film. I don't want to make a gore porn or, you know, a comedy. I mean, Psycho Cop still says funny things, but it's in a much tenser setting because he's actually harvesting the guilty and sending them to hell. He talks on his iPhone to Satan all the way through the film. It's, you know, we brought it into the modern times.
Love it, love it.
Yeah,
Yeah,
well,
this has got to happen. I mean, I love the idea.
there's a lot of the book of Revelations in it. I don't know if you're familiar with that book in the Bible, but that's the end times, and police officer Joe Vickers is very well versed in the book of Revelations.
Yes.
Yes.
Awesome,
Yeah.
awesome.
Yeah, so like I
So
said, much darker, much darker.
is this something that we could potentially see in the near future?
It is. It's really just a question of the financing and, you know, do we all want to get together and make it? Can we clear our schedules enough to make it and agree on when to make it? I mean, there's, you know, a few little roadblock like the money.
Right.
Oh yeah, well,
But other
that's
than
a big
that,
one.
you know, I mean, listen, it's a guaranteed winner. I mean, there's no way you lose money on it. None. Zero. Zero chance of that. So it would be nice to have three of them, you know, so you could then box them together and sell them
The
as a
trilogy.
three-piece
No,
set.
yeah, absolutely.
If it was me, if I owned it, I do not own it. I'm just the star of it, you know. There's an executive producer. There always is. So, you know, we'll see what he wants to do. But Nick Vallelonga, who I mentioned previously, who won the Academy Award for Green Book, who was Mike in Psycho Cop Returns, he's indicated that he'd be interested in being part of it. And also Adam Rifkin, who directed Psycho Cop Returns. So I'd love to
Awesome.
work with Rifkin again. You know, we had a screening of the film a year ago in Hollywood at this, you know, prestigious screening room. It was packed, it was full. It was the first time we'd ever screened the full print of the director's cut. And this film completely worked. It just dominated. It was fantastic to watch it with a, you know, a discerning film loving audience, and the first time we'd ever seen it that way. And so every kill worked, every joke worked. I mean, it was a very heady evening. And the best part of the evening was the director of Maniac Cop was there, Mr. Bill Lustig. Now, I
That's
never met him, you know, and I'd never even watched Maniac Cop. I've been asked about it, you know, for years. And people always used to come up to me and say, "Hey, in a fight between Psycho Cop and Maniac Cop, who would win?" And so I told Lustig, I said, "You know, people have been asking me this for 25 years, who would win?" And he goes, "Well," I said, "you're looking at him." So,
I mean,
you
you got
know,
the
you
devil
don't
on
get the
your
chance to
side.
drop one-liners on, you know, people as often as you'd like, but when you do, you got to take them.
Well,
You're right.
you know, Bobby, I mean, that was something else I was going to bring up, and that was, you know, when you read your lines for Psycho Cop 1 and Psycho Cop Returns Part 2, you had to have said to yourself, this is the most one-liners. Yeah, I mean, did you guys set a record? It seemed like every line that you blurted
It
was
could
a
be. I don't
one-liner.
know. I didn't think of
Looking
it that
for a
way. You know,
cop,
I
you
was
know?
just trying to figure out how to make him, how to say him, you know, in character. I mean, you're not really thinking of the impact of them. They're just, you know, they're just lines that you're saying as you go through the journey with this character. And the character changed a lot from the first one to the second one, you know, and I mean, the tone changed, the directors changed. I mean, a lot of it changed. And so I was just trying to stay afloat and find the thing that worked best for me. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, it's still me up there doing the thing.
Hell yeah.
So I have to protect myself, you know, and also reach accommodation with, you know, the director and the producer. And although I had a lot of free rein on that film, I didn't really have to explain anything. I just did it. You
Yeah,
know,
that's so badass.
I'm not an actor that asks for direction. You know, if they have something to say to me, I've got it already figured out. You know, I mean, I'm ready to go when I get there. That I don't need positive reinforcement from you. I have to make the choices, and then I also have to execute them on screen. I mean, you know, certain times you would react bigger to certain things. but you're in a tiny little, you know, tight frame that you can't move your head at all. They say, don't move. Whatever you do, don't move. So you have to adjust accordingly to what the camera is seeing. Your performance is dictated by the lens, you know, and that's something you have to learn over time, is how to modulate that correctly. You watch the big, great actors, film actors, they know exactly how little you need to do. I mean, it's the amateur that doesn't understand, you know, the stillness that's necessary, and that an actor acts with their eyes, not with their head. You know, I mean, that's the one, you see all this movement from people, that's a huge mistake. I mean, the stillness is what really works. So right. That's what you're striving to learn how to do, is to control those things.
And that's what I was going to ask also, is did you have any kind of any one particular or a few different particular horror icons that you sort of kind of got inspiration from?
Whenever well, sure, sure. Of course. I mean, you know, Vincent Price and Christopher Lee and those guys, they were they love their madness. And so that's what Psychocop right. does, is he loves his madness. I mean, that's all it is. And I want to have fun. Right. I don't want to be a gloomy time. I want us to have a pleasant time together. So that's, you know, the trick in that is, you know, to switch from being somewhat normal to being psycho in a breath, you know, right. without effort, without people seeing you do that. So that's the trick.
That's awesome.
You can learn how to do that. It's easy. Right.
And that's what easy I was telling Otis.
Anybody can do it.
Right. That's what I was telling Otis. Like, I mean, I like the first one, don't get me wrong, but part two, Psycho Cop, like, it instantly became a classic to me. I was like, yeah, I love this fucking movie.
Well,
this movie,
you've got Julie so Strain great. And Melanie Good, and, you know, some naked girls running around. It's not hard on the eyes.
and speaking of naked girls, why don't we just jump right into Dick Dickster?
Well,
why don't you for those who haven't seen it, I've been, you know, trying to get people up
Thank
to speed
you.
with this movie.
Yeah, it's so awesome.
I think it's an instant cult comedy classic.
You would think, right? I mean, it hasn't found that audience yet, but I believe it will. I just, you know, when, that's it. The question. But, you know, it's a funny thing. Like, we were talking about Psycho Cop Returns. I waited 25 years for the reviews.
Okay? Wow.
Yeah, I know. I mean, when they released it, Vinegar Syndrome put it out in a director's cut.
Right.
Blu-ray release. That I got reviewed for the first time on that film. And, you know, it was pretty fun. It was pleasant.
Right.
You know, it confirmed my genius. You know, I made some correct choices is what it confirmed.
Oh, absolutely.
But Dexter really, you know, is a compendium of my experience in Hollywood. I mean, really, you know, he's Dick Dixer's a director, and he's a racist, he's misogynistic, he's homophobic, he's all the isms.
He's an alcoholic.
He drunk the whole movie. A bottle of Jim Beam never leaves his head. So it was a lot of fun to play it, you know. It was born of several different conceits. I mean, I worked with David O. Russell, who directed me in a Kentucky Fried Chicken commercial. And, you know, I was prepared to fight him that day because I had seen some of his, you know, him chewing out Lily Tomlin, et cetera, et cetera. He got in a fist fight with George Clooney. So, you know, I expected there to be a fight, but we got along okay. But, you know, that dynamic on the screen of where there's a loose cannon like that, you know, who's going to go off. Now, you know, at some point in the day, he's going to go off. He's going to lose it on somebody.
Right.
Is it going to be you? So, you know, you learn how to tiptoe a little carefully around these guys. And so that's really kind of where it came from. And then my cousin worked for a company called The Asylum. And we were doing Mockbusters, you know. And so I had this crew. And I realized, you know, I can make this thing. And the funny thing is years ago, I was in one of the first famous films, Hollywood Shuffle, with Robert Townsend. And he made that for $100,000 on his credit cards, right? And it was a big, huge smash. It paved the way for him as a black filmmaker, you know. And it was really, it only took me 30 years to learn the lesson from it, which is make your own movie. Right. You know, here I am running around. Getting a part here, you know, and suddenly I realized, you know, you need to go out there and make the movie you want to make. So that's what I did. And I was interested in making a mockumentary after being on The Office, right? I wanted to go show these people that I knew what I was doing. I'd learned how to do it, and I could do it better than them because of the pace that I did it at. I call it farce pace. If you're familiar with old record players, right, they came at 16 speed, 33 speed, 45, and 78.
78. Well,
this is a 78 right here. This is the speed we're running at. I mean, everything is an assault. There's a fight in every scene. There's a conflict in every scene. So that's, you know, what we did, and it was a lot of fun. I hope people go watch it. Dick Dixter.
That's right.
Laugh your ass off.
That's right. They want Dixter.
Where can they watch it? Where can they find it?
It's on Google Play. It's on Amazon Prime. It's on any place streaming, really. Just put it, Google it in there, and it's coming up. Dick Dixter. It's easy to remember. The name, we changed it right the night before we started shooting. There was the character's original name was Dick Dix, D-I-X-X. And that happened as a result of walking down Hollywood Boulevard one day, actually Vine. And there's a character with a star named Richard Dix, Dick Dix. And I was like standing there right above a star going, Dick Dix, Dick Dix. This is a great name. Well, I get the script to his son, Robert Dix, who was a famous actor. He was in a bunch of movies in the early 70s and late 60s. Some really strange titles. You know, Plan 9 from Outer Space, this guy's in.
Oh, awesome.
So he's been around. So I get the – he's retired living in Arizona. He reads the script. He threatens to sue me.
Oh, shit.
Because I use the name Dix. He's all offended, right? You know, I mean, yeah. I'm using this name. You can use any name you want, you know. But when you're making a little movie, the last thing you want to hear is lawyer. The last thing you want is a lawsuit.
Right.
You know, some clown, he's got money, time to sue you. He's going to do it.
Right.
So I'm laying there in bed, and I'm going, what am I going to, you know, because for a couple of years, all I'm thinking is Dick Dix, Dick Dix, Dick Dix, Dick Dix, you know, day and night preparing, working. And suddenly I just sat up in the middle of the night and went, Dixter. I knew what it was. And, you know, then after that, we just tried to cram it in the movie as many times as we can. I mean, I don't even know how many times we say Dick Dixter, but it's probably at least 50
there's
got to
be a record.
Every time it's we, you know, it's just one of those repeated tricks that you do. And so every chance we got, we used his name.
Right. And that's it's absolutely hilarious. Like it's one of those ones like Otis is it's a instant cult comedy classic.
It should be.
It's if anybody watching, if you haven't seen it yet, go watch it now.
Yeah, yeah. Tell your friends about it.
Oh yeah.
And your grandma.
Write a review. buy a copy of it. I mean, support it. I mean, I'm still waiting on it to, you know, but I haven't really been, you know, I'm not one of these guys out on the media doing social media and all that kind of stuff all the time. I mean, it's just not,
right.
Doesn't interest me. People will find it if it's meant to be found, you know. It's like Psycho Cop or Bob Vance. I mean, you, when you try to push it, it maybe it doesn't happen. It's when you want it to happen. Something happens eventually.
Right.
Yeah.
You don't have
to put it out there. I mean, the work is good. Really, really good. I mean, I worked really hard on that. I can't tell you how hard I worked on that. I mean, it was years of work. I edited that. I mean,
Wow.
Every frame of it.
Well, it definitely shows. It definitely shows that you put a lot of love and a lot of thought into it.
Oh, yeah. If you go from the original script to the what ended up, I mean, it's, you know.
Oh, I could imagine.
It's funny. I met Harold Ramis, right? The great Harold Ramis.
Oh,
he
wow.
came to a screening of Phyllis's Wedding at Greg Daniels' house. He walks up, first thing out of his mouth is he says, Bob Vance, Vance Refrigeration. I look at Harold Ramis. I go, that's my line. Harold Ramis. But I'm watching Harold Ramis watch this episode, right? So when I tell Michael, if you ever lay a finger on Phyllis, I'll kill you. That was straight Psycho Cop, by the way.
That's awesome.
Well, Harold Ramis, he just kills Harold Ramis. So right there, I'm like, okay, I'm happy. I can die happy now. I just killed Harold Ramis.
Right.
But, excuse me. What was the point of this story? I had some point. Harold Ramis said, the happiest day of your life is when you wrap the film. The worst day of your life is when you watch the first assembly of it. And that is true. I mean, I watched the first assembly of Dick Dixter was 2 hours and a half or 2:15. And, of course, a comedy can't be that long. But I mean, I was just appalled. I was like, oh my God, what have we done? I mean, I was really screwed up from it. I mean, I was hurting from it. I was like, I cannot, what? But I just went to work. You know, the work just began right then. I was, right. You know, all along the line, I kept thinking, okay, the work is over. Oh, no. Just kept getting more and more and more. People ask me all the time, do you like being an actor or a producer? And I'm like, an actor. Being a producer, you know. Somebody, they said to me, can we get a line through on the, you know, on the movie? And I'm like, well, who's going to do that? You're looking at it. Who did it? It was me. Nobody else. I mean, who are you going to turn to? It's the producer. It's me. I got to deliver it. You know, the distribution company wants that. You got to give them the goods. So somebody had to do it.
Right.
Somebody had to. Right. You've also done some voice acting, some voiceover type things. I've pondered possibly doing a little voice. I think you have a great voice for that kind of stuff. Absolutely. You know.
Yeah, it's a whole thing. I'm out of Hollywood now. I don't live there anymore. I left after I moved out last June. I was done with California. You know, enough after 40 years of it. It's just not a happy place to live in right now. And right. So I'm back in the hills in West Virginia, and I'm happy as can be to be out of it. If somebody wants to give me a bucket of money to do something, I'll consider it. I mean, I'm still paying my dues. I didn't want to. For years of paying those screen actors, you go, oh, damn it. So there was a big bill build up, and I was like, I'm not going to pay it. And then finally, I read something about the office coming back. I was like, I better, because they'll make me join again. You know, so I better pay it. So, you know, what has that union ever done for me? I mean, that's all I want to say right now.
Right. Well, I mean, okay, well, I mean, you mentioned, you know, being called back maybe from the office. Was Bob Vance was just a kind of a pop-in character from recurring character from, yeah. But he kind of became a regular.
Well, not really. I mean, and a regular would have been in every episode.
Every episode.
I mean, I just came into the parties. That's the only time you ever see me is whenever they're having a party, I'm there. Bob is there with Phyllis, you know. And all I'm doing is reacting usually to Michael. I mean, I always called it, I said I patented it. It's called perplexed consternation. That's all I had to do. Was just look at him like, what the fuck are you talking about? You know? So that's
that
it.
Is what I was going
to
say.
People used to say to me all the time, why doesn't Bob just beat Michael up? And I'm like, okay, first of all, it's not funny. Okay. Second, it's no contest. That would be over before you even. I mean, seriously, come on. That's not even. Come on.
And
so,
that was one of my
where do we
favorite
go
ones.
From there? You know, I want more appearances, not less. So I'm
trying
to be on those guys' good side. I don't want to beat him up. I'm kissing his ass whenever I can.
You'd wrap him like a pretzel.
Yeah, that's right.
That was one of my favorite. That was one of my favorite ones. Was the Christmas party where Phyllis was as dressed up as Santa Claus.
Oh yeah.
That
to hell, Scott.
I had me laughing my ass off. That was one of the, again, another one of the best ones. I don't know what, like, it was just one of those ones that popped to me. I just found that scene so damn hilarious. And my wife and I, we watch The Office literally every day.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, it's one of those ones that, yeah, that one. And then the other scene that you were talking about, that one really, that was probably.
Well, there's been some good ones. I mean, we make 187 episodes of that thing. I mean, there's so many of them. It's hard to keep them all straight anymore. But, I mean, there's some that stand out above the others. I mean, Dinner Party has to be one of the greatest pieces, half hours of television ever done.
Oh, yeah. That one's absolutely.
Of course,
hilarious.
That's based on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, the great play.
Yeah.
And with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, I watched it again a couple weeks ago. I mean, talk about getting after it. Well, wow. I mean, I think there was some alcohol involved in that shoot. I'm just saying, you know, from the perspective of years later.
So Dick Dixter showed up
Taylor
to the party.
Seemed to be imbibing. I mean, I'm not against, you know, doing whatever you got to do. I mean, Nick Cage was drunk as hell the whole time he was making Leave in Las Vegas. That was two-fifths a day. By the time he was shooting that, he started like 2 months before he started shooting that, he started drinking. Oh, wow. You're playing drunk. You got to be drunk. You can't play drunk in close up. That was one of Marlon Brando's big lines, was you can't play drunk in close up. You got to be drunk. So yeah. I met Marlon Brando one time and I told him that I did that.
He's like, well, Bobby, I didn't actually write that.
Marlon. I mean, that's, I wasn't shy in those days. I'd go right up to you and talk to you.
So, all right, then did you take your, you know, those words and incorporate that in the Dickster? Were you drunk then?
No, I wasn't. I mean, I didn't have one single drink the whole time I made that. That was just iced tea and diluted Coke. Mm-hmm. Being drunk, trying to do that. We shot that in 6 days. I had no schedule. I wasn't.
Whoa.
We made that movie in 6 days.
Holy shit.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I never would have guessed that.
We shot all of it in 6 days. So that's there's no time. Incredible. You can't, you know, being drunk is depressed. You know, it doesn't work. I mean,
yeah, no.
I used to play golf with this friend of mine, and he had a drinking problem. And sometimes you'd see him over there taking nips out of this bottle, right? And then the next shot, he'd duff a 3-wood. And he'd be like, what the hell? You know, right? He'd be all upset. I'd be like, would you stop drinking? You can't play golf when you're drinking. Come on. I mean, you can't really act when you're drinking.
I
always said, you know, about Robert Downey Jr. when he was using cocaine back when he made Chaplin. I'm like, that performance is ruined now for me, because every time I watch it, I'm going to say, oh, he's – Look at how high he is.
Yeah.
And I worked with Tom Sizemore, right, who was one of the, you know, it was a really bad when it comes to that stuff.
Yeah.
My buddy, I did two movies in a row I did with him. I did The Headhunter, which later was, it's an Elvis movie, right? And then we did Stiletto. And so the Stiletto director said, should we hire him? What did those producers think of him? And I said, they fired him. And because he was using meth. And he said, well, what could go wrong? Well, let's see.
Everything.
You know, I get the phone call. They say, listen, we're not shooting up at Universal tomorrow. Tom has been arrested up in Bakersfield. You know, he got busted with meth with some hooker at some hotel up in Bakersfield. What could go wrong? So I felt a little guilty there for a while. I was like, hey, I didn't mean to bring this. But he and I almost had a big fight one night. He shoved me unexpectedly, and somebody was like, oh, Schaefer's going to knock him out. Right. Because you got to say to me first, I'm going to put my hands on you, you know, because if I'm not ready for that, then I could go, you know, I could go flying somewhere.
Right.
So, I mean, there's rules when it comes to fight scenes in Hollywood. And,
absolutely.
He broke them. I mean, he was using, he wouldn't shut up that night. I was sick of him by the end of that night. I knew everything about his dad playing football and his brother. I was ready. All right, shut up.
Oh, man,
but again, this guy, you know, he goes from making Private Ryan to now he's making these, you know, low budget B movies. I mean, because he's using. So, yeah. I mean, he had a bad accident on a movie last year where the stuntman said, do not try to drive that car out of there. And he did. And he hit a guy and put him in the hospital. I mean, that kind of thing is just irresponsible. And he gets
what
away.
What could go wrong?
A lot of that kind of stuff, irresponsibilities in Dickster.
Yeah. Right. Again, Dickster, go watch it.
Yeah,
everyone.
Go watch it.
Now, review.
You mentioned Universal, so I have to ask. Universal Monsters, your favorite.
What's that?
The Universal Monsters.
What
is your favorite? Do you have a favorite?
Oh, I guess Frankenstein is the, you know, I mean, I go back to those. Those are the things I watched, Creature Feature. But I wasn't really a kid of the movies. I never wanted to be in the movies. I never wanted to be an actor. This is an accidental career, okay? I just, after I was in it, I determined to be the best I could at it. I mean, that's all. And the other thing is they couldn't make me quit. But, I mean, I wasn't really a Creature Feature guy. You know, I mean, on Friday nights, sometimes we'd stay up and watch some of that stuff. But I was an outdoor guy. I was a basketball player. So I wasn't a TV kid, you know. And I was a reader. Reading is the most important thing that actors do.
Right.
People don't understand that. The more you read, the more you know. The more plays you read, the more books you read, the more, you know. I mean, those are all things that inform these character choices that hopefully you get to make. So the better reader you are, the better actor you are.
Sure. Now, the play True West, yes. I believe, had something to do with the whole Psycho Cop.
It's a huge part of my life. I mean, I got Psycho Cop because of it. That was the audition piece at the Psycho Cop.
Wow.
We weren't reading the script. We read True West, and I already knew it. I'd just seen Malkovich and Sinise do it. I had worked on it in class. I was too young for it at the time, but I knew that part, and so I didn't even have to look at it when I read it. I mean, I tore that thing up. I booked that job immediately.
That's awesome.
Then later, I did the 20th anniversary out in Pasadena of that show. I mean, after that, I mean, the Quaid brothers did it. Philip Seymour Hoffman did it on Broadway with John C. Reilly. I mean, this play is a real test. And so I loved it. I mean, the power of it is just, it's incredible. We were in a little little space, and I refer to it as shaking their peaches because, you know, Lee's a drifter. He's a drunk. He's a fighter. He's a bad boy. And he's very loud, and this is a little space. So, I mean, you get to use all your gifts. I mean, that's the thing about theater acting is that you get to do it for 2.5 hours straight, consecutive, nonstop. Don't mess up, right? The pressure. Right. And film is, you know, you screw up, you can do another one.
Right.
Let's do
right.
another one. How about we do another one? So, you know, especially with video now, we just keep rolling. I mean, before you just have to cut and talk about it and do all the, you know, the film stuff. But now that video is so cheap, they just keep rolling. So you go from the mistake right to the next take. So that's one reason I love that play so much. And again, so here's a funny story. And I like telling this. I met Sam Shepard's ex-wife, Olan Ray is her name. You remember that name, Olan. You don't run into that name very often. Well, it turns out she's the producer of this play. So I'm up for this play, and they keep bringing me in, bringing me back, and I want to do this part. So they said, well, it's up to Olan. So I say to her by way of conversation, oh, I just read about you in this biography of your ex-husband. She goes, oh, why were you reading that? And I was like, well, I was doing the 20th anniversary of True West out in Pasadena. And she goes, oh, are they still doing that? Like, yeah, like they still do Hamlet and Macbeth.
Right.
They're still doing it. And 100 years from now, they'll still be doing it.
And like so, cats.
That night, I get a call. I said, yeah. Listen, I talked to Olan. She just doesn't think this is going to work out. So I was, at that point, I was happy. I was like, all right, the hell with it. Can you imagine what a pain in the butt she would have been for the 2 months of rehearsals?
Oh, my goodness. That's hilarious.
They're still doing it.
Now, Bobby, even though you said you didn't really want to, you know, getting into acting and being an actor wasn't really your type of thing. You never envisioned yourself doing that. No. But you did end up going to acting school. Do you think that that is needed for anybody who has ever thought about, I mean, do you have to spend the money to go to acting school, or is it something that you can probably learn on your own?
Yeah, there's a craft, there's a technique. Can you repeat it, right? Great golfers can repeat the swing under pressure. That's what actors do. They repeat the take under pressure. Mm-hmm. So you have to learn how to do that. You have to learn how to save that energy to do that correctly. I mean, there's a real technique to it. I mean, if not everybody's Anthony Hopkins.
Right, absolutely.
You guys are. Morgan Freeman, Robert Duvall. The truth tellers, I call those guys. I mean, they have the goods. I mean, I was watching Jeff Bridges right before I came on with you guys, and the film was called To Hell and Back. He's so underrated. I mean, he's so good. It's effortless. Mm-hmm. You know, he's been doing it his whole life. I mean, he grew up doing it. I watched Last Picture Show, which is one of my favorite movies ever. And because Timothy Bottoms is a buddy of mine, and so that Last Picture Show, I mean, I always measured. That's when I first got interested in. I was like, what are these guys doing? You know, this is that movie really woke me up to film, I think. And of course, Cybill Shepherd at the time, you know, the pool scene. I'm like, oh, can we watch that yet? We didn't have VHS. You know, that was it. It was just sort of a lingering memory in your brain.
Right.
Like, wait a minute. Didn't she take her clothes off?
Right. Could there be a Dick Dickster 2?
I don't know. I mean, Richard Grieco originally said to me, let's make this a series. He was at Showtime. He makes this thing, American Gigolo or some crazy thing. And I said, a series? But, you know, I resisted. I resist lots of things. And then I go, okay, yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, you could do a half an hour with that. I mean, that would be
absolutely
24 funny minute weekly minutes. You know, I mean, that right. world is, and that world, that's actually, that's not that far from the actual. I mean,
yeah,
I know there's a few smudge marks here and there, but really, I mean, when he's casting, that's what it's like. That casting is, you know, except for the fighting. You know, and that guy deserved it. He had that coming.
Well, you did stomp on his dick.
Away, but I kicked his butt. Stomping there.
Oh my goodness! Oh, man. That was awesome. So I don't know. Maybe I did ask this already. Do you prefer comedy or horror? Or and then a two part, major films, full length feature films versus sitcoms.
Oh, well, I like films. I like feature films. As far as comedy or drama, comedy is obviously a lot easier. I mean, in some respects, I mean, on the psyche, it's not easier in the terms of the execution. It's very difficult. Mm-hmm. People always, what's Steve Carell like? I'm like, he's busy. He's working. Mm-hmm. He's figuring out the next scene because the workload was so high, you know. Both serve their purpose. I mean, Hollywood makes about 500 films a year, right? And how many of those are good? 10?
Yeah, true.
10, maybe.
If that, yeah, right.
I mean, it's depressing if you look at what they're churning out. But every now and then, the lightning will strike. There'll be a well-written piece and a well-directed piece and a well-acted piece because you got to have all three of those things. And they forget about the well-written and the well-acted. Most of the time, and they're all about the directing of it, you know, and so that's Marvel.
Right.
Right.
Into those films.
In a nutshell.
Those aren't real films to me. Those are comic books. Those are cartoons.
I agree.
Don't see that as real filmmaking. You know, the 30s and 40s, there's a reason they call that the golden era. I mean, I watch a lot of Turner classic movies, and people yes. actually talk in those movies.
Right.
I mean, they're real movies. I mean, so.
Right.
That era is sadly is not how we do it now.
Right. That's recently we were doing a series on the universal monsters. That's why Otis asked you earlier which was your favorite one.
Frankenstein. I like Frankenstein.
Right.
That's the universal monster, right?
Right. Yeah. And but like us going back and doing all this research and me, you know, I watched them as a kid, but rewatching all these as an adult, it's like I said, it's they had something. I guess it's maybe soul. I don't know what it is, but
yeah, that's a good word.
Most films nowadays just don't have.
And the film, but the film audience wasn't as sophisticated either. That era. True. I mean, you have to look at those things about when they were made and apply that, you know, to 1930s America. That's a different world.
Right.
Almost 100 years ago. So, right. I mean, if you look at it in that historical context, I think you can, you know, obviously the decades.
Right.
Each decade turns out a certain type of film, as it turns out. And I'm not so sure that the, you know, the 2020s are going to be well remembered.
Right.
Not like the 30s.
Not like
it's an 30s. All or nothing proposition now, right? You either... it's all, I mean, the way films are made now, they're made for China, actually. So that's the really terrible part about it. But the audience, there's 1.4 billion people there. That's a bigger potential audience than 330 billion. So, you know, films are made for the world, not America anymore. So that's why you can't make little movies anymore and hope to make money at it. Because the distribution model is not there. I mean, the big films, they get all the screens, and a little film got no shot, no chance. I mean, Sex, Lies, and Videotape was at one time the most successful low budget film of all time. It mm-hmm. was made for $1 million. James Spader, you know, had a good cast, and they grossed $25 million. So it was huge. You know, My Funny Greek Wedding, another one. That one, I mean, they made that for $6 million or, you know, less than that. And they did $450 million worldwide. I mean, that's a huge, I mean, the legal battles still aren't over on that one. I mean, everybody's suing everybody over the money on that because there's so much of it, right? So I remember talking to that producer, Larry Estes, and I was pitching him something, an action film. And he said, what's the budget? And I said, well, it's $5 million. And he goes, you can't make a movie for $5 million. You can make a movie for $1 million, or you can make a movie for $10 million. There's no life in between, none. You can't do it for two. You can't do it for three. You got to do it for one or 10. At 10, you got a chance to get distributed. At one, you got a chance to, you know, to get a breakout in the art houses. And so you have to factor all those things in when you go about making these things.
Yeah, we got about 4 or 5 minutes left, and I came across a story that I don't think I've heard you tell, although it was mentioned in previous shows that you've been on, and that's the breakup cameo. For, you know, most people know cameo is something where you can pay an actor. He'll wish you a happy birthday. He'll, you know, just say hi. How are you? You actually had the break to.
Yeah, I did.
Up.
I thought I was really good at it because I'd practiced that before in real life. I drew in real life. It's really not about me. It's about you. No, that's not that's not how it went. I had some, you know, some practice at that. So I was able to, you know, bumble my way through that one.
Hell yeah.
Did you ever get any feedback on that, on how
that
went?
No, that one, no, thankfully, no. I don't really like feedback. I don't really want feedback. If I wanted feedback, I'd, you know, I'd get in another business.
Right. Oh, man, right.
Oh, man,
it was hilarious.
I'm stunned. I mean, like, I have to ask you guys, who put you up to this? Why in the world would
Jackal
you ask
Monkey.
Me to do this? Somebody put you up to it. I want to know who it is. Is there an ex out there? Well, okay, you get what you asked for.
Well, hey, it's been a hell of a time. We appreciate you taking your time
and
your data.
I'm an expert at these things. We're talking about my career, so
right.
It's not a career; it's a life. I mean, people that think of it as a career, you better rethink that. It's got to be a life. You've got to do it totally. There can be nothing else. Nothing
Absolutely.
Else. It's total. Yeah, it's total immersion. You have to, you know, say goodbye to everything else. I did anyway. I mean, I'm jealous of the people who are able to have 6 kids and the wife and the house and all that and still do the thing. Good on you. Bastards.
Bastards.
And I'm better than you. So there you go.
Hey, that's
like
it.
My commitment is much more total.
There you go, my friend.
So I hate actors that talk about acting, right? It's one of the worst topics you can ever talk about. So I try not to, you know, pontificate about it. But like you said before, yeah, you need to have that training. I mean, scene study and improv training and all those things are going to be very useful. And you need to do theater because that's what real acting is. I mean,
right.
I had this kid, and my teacher was Peggy Fury, and she was the most famous teacher in Hollywood at the time. And there was this guy, and he kept doing the scene. And the goal of this class is only do the scene once or twice. You don't want to do it 3 or 4 times because everybody got sick of it. So he kept doing the same scene over and over. And she finally sat him down and she said, you know, I've been talking to you every week about you need to do this and do this and do this. And she said, I suddenly realized you want to be John Ritter. And John Ritter was a nice guy. I met John Ritter and I liked John Ritter. And it was a shame the way he died. That was medical malpractice at its worst.
Yeah.
He was a very funny guy. And later he turned out to be very dramatic in the Sling Blade movie. He was terrific in that.
Absolutely. That was the
really
that's
good.
One of my
really
favorite
good.
Roles.
He was friends with Dwight Yoakam and so Dwight, you know, put him in that role and he was great.
That's awesome. Jackal Monkey, any final words for
Mr. Schaefer. I mean, other than thank you very much for joining us, and I'm a huge fan. Like I said, we watch The Office every night, and
enjoy.
Everybody who hasn't seen Dick Dixter, go watch it. It is a comedy, instant comedy classic.
You will laugh.
It is hilarious.
I promise.
Yeah, you will I laugh promise, out loud too.
Multiple yes, times. I guarantee it.
O-O-L. No lie.
I guarantee it. The scene with Teddy, man, never mind. Now, I hired him because he fit perfectly into the Rock'em Sock'em Rotobops. And I was like, that's going to be funny. So perfect. When I'm cutting that, the editor goes, let's shorten that up. And I'm like, no, let's make it longer. let's make the noises longer. I want to hear the punching.
Oh,
and so he's
man.
Like, no, you don't need to put any sound effects in that. I'm like, yeah, that's what you do. That's funny.
That is very funny.
Every time you kick him in the nuts, the director says to me, did we do it once too often? And I'm like, let's do it again.
Let's do it again?
Let's do another one. I'll take
not
one
not enough.
One more time.
One more time. I think we kicked him in the nuts 6 or 7 times. And every time, you know, it hurts. As it should. And so, you know, you get a laugh. I mean, if you don't laugh at that, then I think there's something wrong.
There's something definitely wrong. And especially if you don't if you don't laugh at the guy whose name Hugnuts.
Hugnuts.
I mean,
Hugnuts now, you know, I hated that name. is that real? Hugnuts got in trouble, didn't he?
Oh man.
Hugnuts paid the price.
Hugnuts paid the price. He got a good old you know, Frankie, dick stomping.
He works in soft R or R rated movies, a lot of them, and so he, you know, is experienced with that. So he's kind of a Frankie Cullen. We had an actual porn star in that role. I forget his name, but he had long hair. He looked like Fabio, and it didn't work out. And so we ended up using Frankie, but that other guy's pretty well known. And I came across his work one day, and I was like, "Whoa! I'm glad we didn't hire him."
Oh man.
Oh my goodness! Oh my goodness! Well, we're about out of time, Robert.
Thank you.
But I want you to hang on just for a minute. We're just going to throw you in the back chat. We both want to say goodbye off. You know the show. Thank you again for taking the time out to speak with us. And hold tight, my friend. Man. That was absolutely awesome. What a funny guy. Great stories. I mean, this is what people like to hear. Yeah. This is what people like to hear. All the backstories and everything. This has been an absolutely awesome show. I want to thank everyone over there at Scurry Face that has watched us over there. Everybody there. Night of Living Dreads over there on our Facebook group. Thank you guys for checking it out. This will obviously go over on our YouTube page, the Night of the Living Dreads podcast on YouTube. Hey, Jackal Monkey, man, you hit the bullseye again, man, with this guest. This Robert was such a Bobby.
Such an amazing guy. An awesome guy, awesome actor, and I mean, just all around good fucking dude. I mean, this has been one hell of a show, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Absolutely, and we got a little special announcement that we'll make after the show, but there has been a little change with our Saturday show over there at Scurry Face. It's going to come on Monday, I think Sunday or Monday. We'll figure it out. But it is not going to go live just because our guest, Marcus. They have to do it on
agreements and stuff.
Yeah, certain times, and we have to, you know, go through a few things there to make sure it goes off without a hitch. So, but that's coming. Don't worry. Writer, director, Night of the Living Dead Part 2 coming to NLD. So With that being said, thank you guys in the chat. Thank you everyone who joined in. We're going to get the hell out of here and we're going to go talk for a few more minutes with Dick.
Dick Dickster.
Dick Dickster. Go watch it. You better. If you don't, I'm coming after you. All right. We'll see you guys soon.
Later.